The push to increase the use of civil citations for youth in Florida. And 8 months on, what does a U.S. Supreme Court decision mean for jailed youth in Duval County? Well, it depends. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank, filling in for Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And just ahead, juvenile justice. 8 months after the highest court in the land ruled life sentences for minors unconstitutional, Tessa Duval of the Florida Times Union examines what effect, if any, it's had on youth sentenced in Duval County. Also, iCare's Pastor Philip Baber and Nancy Ricker joins us to talk about the use of civil citations in juvenile cases. Then later, spoken word artist and activist Ebony Payne English talks her new book, Secrets of Ma'at. Plus, OneCore 924 helps former collegiate and professional athletes transition into non-athletic life, and all of the weekend sports with Cole Pepper. All of that and more ahead, but first this hour, no second chance. That's the headline for Tessa Duval's latest article in the Times Union about juvenile justice, specifically life sentences for young offenders. The issue is also closely related to the mission of iCare's Nancy Ricker and Pastor Philip Baber. To increase the use of civil citations, which function in many cases like promises to appear in court or traffic tickets. 10,000 kids were arrested for petty crimes in Florida last year. Ricker and Baber want to prevent more of them from being swallowed up by the justice system. What are your thoughts? Let us know by calling 549-2937. Again, that number is 549-2937. Tessa, I want to start with you. No second chance. That's a pretty bleak headline. Can you give us an idea of what went into this very thoughtful piece and very thorough piece?
Absolutely. Thank you. So this story that ran in yesterday's Florida Times Union is about the Supreme Court ruling that mandatory life without parole for juvenile offenders is unconstitutional and that juveniles should only receive life without parole if they are the rare and uncommon offender. And so, but what we're seeing in Florida is that judges are still issuing very lengthy sentences, that prosecutors are still pursuing life in many of these cases. And so if you're pursuing life and you're still getting very lengthy sentences, a lot of advocates and a lot of attorneys very well versed in this area are saying, that's not what the Supreme Court meant. And it's especially relevant in Florida because Florida is one of five states with the highest concentration of juveniles sentenced to life without parole. And there are 58 right here in Duval County out of 550, give or take, in the whole state.
Right. And actually, that was going to be my next question here, talking about the specifics of how many cases in Duval County are actually affected by this ruling. We have, you said, 58 cases total here in Duval County?
That's correct. There are 58 cases of homicide involving juveniles sentenced to life without parole. And because of the high court's ruling, at the time when these juveniles were sentenced, they were all given mandatory automatic life without parole, is a minimum mandatory. That's what the judge had to give to these young people. And so now the high court has said it can't be automatic. You have to consider their youthfulness. You have to consider the severity of the crime and all of these other factors. Now these 58 individuals in Jacksonville and, you know, hundreds more around the state are getting new sentencing hearings. And this is where we're seeing that prosecutors are often seeking life all over again, and that judges are, many times these cases are going back to the same judge who originally sentenced them. And so one thing that advocates and attorneys are very worried about is that what judge is going to say, I was wrong before, you should have only gotten 25 years. And it's also important to know that the state law carries minimum mandatory. I'm getting tripped over my words this morning.
That's all right.
So, for example, for someone who is convicted of first-degree murder as a juvenile, the judge still has to give them 40 years in that case. And now there are some attorneys around the state who are challenging that, saying that, hey, the Supreme Court said we still needed discretion, and this law isn't letting us have discretion. So it's important to know that there's going to be a lot of legal battles that continue to follow these cases for years to come.
And I want to get back to more of the specifics of your piece this weekend, but I also want to bring in Philip and Nancy, and we also have some calls on the line, and we'll get to those as soon as possible as well. ICARE, although a lot of crimes we're talking about here with Tessa are obviously kind of the most serious. We're talking about homicide. We're talking about crimes that carry penalties or carried penalties of life without parole. But, you know, these are different from the crimes that ICARE is concerned with when it comes to juveniles. But what does the research say about the effect of jail time or arrests on youth going into, you know, the rest of their lives? I mean, does this make it more likely if they get into the system that they could end up committing a crime or before a judge for a crime that Tessa Duvall is talking about? And whoever wants to start.
Absolutely. The research shows that if we arrest a youth for a nonviolent crime and put them in the process, the likelihood of their becoming a criminal, a habitual criminal, is, if I remember correctly, something like 85% chance of that. Whereas if we put them in a restorative justice program using civil citations and put them through a neighborhood accountability board that includes the victim, the offender, and members of the community, where they're held accountable for what they've done, make restitution if necessary and appropriate to the victim and to the community, and they're given a lot of sanctions that they have to go through. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's, as a matter of fact, the sheriff said he thought we were tougher on them than if they were going to jail. But it also gives them the counseling and the tools that they need to be able to make better decisions in the future. And I can tell you, I personally sit, there are four of these neighborhood accountability boards here in Jacksonville now. And I'm so passionate about it that I personally sit on all four of them every opportunity I get. And I see families and lives changed day after day after day. There was a young man who came before the board, one of the boards not long ago, for petty theft. And he and his mom were having a huge problem with this. But, you know, through the counseling that we got and through the community service that he had to do and the other things he had to do, when they came back before the board to have his case reviewed, his mom was so proud of him. He now has finished high school successfully, has two jobs, and is going to college. He will be a productive member of society, as opposed to those who are arrested cost us millions of dollars.
And you credit these diversion programs to that.
Absolutely.
For that. I want to get bring you in, Pastor Philip Baber, here. And, of course, I'm not forgetting the calls on the line, so very quickly here. Civil citations, juvenile justice, life sentences for juveniles, trying juveniles as adults. The juvenile justice system as a whole played a major role in the state attorney and public defender primaries in August. And that people have talked about how it sort of sent a clear message about the current state of juvenile justice in Duval County. Pastor Baber, how exactly moving forward from those elections, talking not just on the local level but on the legislative level in Tallahassee, what is ICARE's mission moving forward?
Well, I think that it is clear that we are seeing a shift in the perception and in the awareness of the American people, including here in Duval and throughout the state of Florida, that we are sick and tired of these severe, draconian measures that are being used to basically turn our children into criminals. We now live in a culture where we have been trained to fear our own children. And so what we are trying to do as an organization is to try to be able to get these children opportunities, second chances to be able to become productive citizens so that they can become good citizens, good productive members of their communities. It is absolutely unconscionable that in this day and age, a young person is not old enough to be able to get an alcoholic beverage. They're not old enough to be able to get a cigarette, but the state thinks that they are old enough to be able to be given a felony and potentially have their lives ruined at that moment.
All right, I want to go to some of your calls. Todd in Atlantic Beach wants to talk about Tessa Duvall's article in the Times Union. Todd, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to give a historical perspective on how youth in the African-American community has been treated over the years. And a lot of it started back with the Nixon administration with his Law on Order and War on Drugs campaign. And it followed through with Reagan and Clinton. And now there are over, I guess, two million African-Americans in jail. And Florida, in Duval County, rates about the highest for doing this, sentencing youth to life. These youth that are being brought back up for another trial by the same judges that imprisoned them in the first place are now getting 15 years or more. So some of them won't get out of jail until they're 60, 70, or 80 years old.
So you're saying that's effectively a life sentence. Is that your comment?
Exactly, especially for African-American males who generally die earlier than white males do.
Okay.
I just want to say one last thing.
Sure.
There's an excellent documentary on Netflix called 13th. It's about the 13th Amendment, and I would urge everybody to watch that so that they can understand more about what is happening and what has happened in a historical perspective regarding the African-American community and the criminal justice system.
Thank you for your perspective, Todd. So Tessa Duvall, what about that concern that, even if it's not an actual life sentence without parole, there was a couple of instances in your article that you talked about some cases where these children will be 60 years old before they actually can see the outside of a prison cell. What's the discussion surrounding that kind of coming to?
He made a couple of excellent points in that phone call. First, I think being the racial dynamic that is at play. It's no secret that children of color are overrepresented in the juvenile justice system. If you take a look at the 10 area cases where a juvenile was sentenced to life without parole for a crime other than homicide, all 10 of them were young black men. One of those cases is the one, Graham versus Florida, that made it up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is where it was ruled unconstitutional on the grounds of being cruel and unusual punishment, that it was unconstitutional to sentence a young person to life without parole for something other than homicide. So I went back and I looked at when all of these young men, some of them aren't as young anymore, but when they'll be getting out of prison, and 7 out of the 10 will be 60 or older. One will be in his 80s. I mean, how can you argue that's not a life sentence? I mean, what life can you truly begin at the age of 80 after being incarcerated for 60 years? So I think that is a really important question that the courts will be tasked with looking at. What is effectively a life sentence? If you gave someone 100 years, obviously that's a life sentence, but it starts to get more nuanced when you get to 40 or 50 years. Is that really life for someone? And that's something that the courts are going to have to grapple with.
Can I jump in on this real fast?
Sure.
I'd just like to add that the prison industrial complex in this country is a blatantly racist system, and the school-to-prison pipeline that helps feed that system demonstrates a disparate impact upon racial communities. I know that Human Rights Watch recently was taking a look at some of the data that Florida compiled of the approximately 10,000 children that Florida puts into the adult prison system, and they definitely saw a pattern statistically that demonstrated that more children of color were being prosecuted as adults than their white counterparts. And so that is part of the reason why ICARE is helping to work with a state collaborative to create a bill that's going to be presented to the Florida State Legislature to be able to take some prosecutorial discretion away across the state so that we can try to end that, so that we can get more kids into these diversionary programs. And I just wanted to let your listeners know that we are going to be talking about that and other issues related to youth crime at our Community Problems Assembly tomorrow, Tuesday, at Christ the King Catholic Church in Arlington.
And we'll definitely get to more of those specifics before we're done with our conversation here today. But I also want to get to some more calls. Gail in Palatka, you're on the air, Gail. What's your question?
Yes, thank you. I'm happy to be on. I agree with Todd, the caller before, about that there has been a real history here of these harsh incarcerations, particularly for black young offenders. I know of a case where a 19-year-old committed a serious offense of kidnapping, but the victim was released unharmed. At 19 years old, he was sentenced to life in prison, and is still in prison today, and that was in 1974. Under today's sentencing guidelines, this particular youth who had no prior criminal history whatsoever would have been sentenced under the youthful offender guidelines and would have been eligible for release, I believe, at age 25. But now he's 62 and still in prison. And really, the system is set up where it will be impossible for him to ever be released due to the matrixes that are used for parole. So I really do think that many of these young people, they really did get no second chance. It was a first offense crime, and then he spent the rest of his life in prison. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Tessa Duvall, in your research for this article, how many of these youthful offenders were actually put in jail after a first-time offense because of a mandatory minimum, or was there clear numbers on that? Or,
well, I don't have the names of all of the local cases, just because that's something I am still working on. I have numbers from an organization that tracks that, but some of them undoubtedly are first-time offenders. When you commit a homicide, it doesn't really matter if that's your first time or not. That is a serious offense, and it is treated as such. It really doesn't matter if you had prior offenses. It does matter in this under the new sentencing law. If you have prior enumerated felonies, that makes a difference. But really, a homicide is obviously treated very seriously by the courts.
Nancy, now can you tell me a little bit about how ICARE addresses the racial component what both of our callers were talking about here, about the disproportionate number of African Americans and Latinos who are represented in prison populations and jail populations in arrest records? How does ICARE specifically address those racial disparities?
Well, I think the best way to describe that is that the vast majority of the young people who come before the neighborhood accountability boards are youth of color, and we're working diligently to make sure that they're getting the chance to not be in that position. And we're working, as Philip said, we're working with 9 other organizations in the state to get a bill passed that would make it mandatory for at least 10 nonviolent misdemeanor offenses to be issued civil citations rather than arrest. And it will have a tremendous impact upon people of color if that occurs. Right now we have Representative Spano and Senator Flores agreeing to sponsor the bill, and tomorrow night at our Community Problems Assembly, we will have Whitfield and Griffin there to speak to the community about their position on this bill. And we've got a meeting scheduled with Senator Bean later to get his position on this. We're pushing all of our legislators to be in support of this bill because it is so important for the lives of our youth of color as well as the others that we give them every opportunity they can to be able to not have a criminal record so that they can achieve their goals. And through this process, we help them identify what their goals are and what it takes to achieve them.
Now, what are your thoughts? Please give us a call. Let us know at 549-2937. We're talking about juvenile justice, civil citations, and life sentences for juvenile offenders. Pastor Baber, can you tell me, kind of build on what Nancy was talking about with this proposed legislation? First of all, is there already a draft of this out there? And what are some of the offenses in those 10 that will be included that would take that prosecute that discretion away from prosecutors.
Sure. And I will note that if I miss any details, Nancy is our subject matter expert on this, but so I will say that I can tell you that we worked on a similar bill last year that went all the way through the Senate. It cleared every hurdle in the Senate. It got hung up in the House. And so that is where our focus is this year, to make sure that we have support from those in the House to be able to get this bill passed. I know that one individual that we are definitely trying to get a meeting with is Representative Jay Fant. Up to this point, he has not been willing to meet with us on this issue. And so we are certainly looking for an opportunity to be able to do that. As for the issues that or the crimes that would be covered by this bill, they are generally nonviolent offenses. I can tell you that simple things such as stealing socks or underage drinking, things of those natures. And if Nancy has anything else to add, I'll defer to her.
Trespassing. But actually, people can go to our website, www.icarejax.org. And there is, if you go to the news section of that, the proposed bill is there with explanations of the 10 nonviolent misdemeanors.
Tessa Duvall, before we go to a couple of callers here, we don't have too much time left, but we're going to try to get to everyone's calls and all the points here. There was something that you talked about in the article as well that you wrote about. It was a review period for certain offenders for their cases. They can be given a certain amount of time and then come up before the review board. It was my understanding from your article that they can actually still be sentenced to life,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Can you explain what that review period is and, you know, what kind of discretion the judge has to kind of level that?
Absolutely. So let's use first-degree murder, for example. That carries, for a juvenile, a minimum mandatory of 40 years. Now, the judge can look at this case and say, this crime was especially heinous, there are these aggravating factors, I believe that this young person should still be sentenced to life. Now, regardless of whether the sentence is 40 years, and it cannot be less than 40 years for first-degree homicide. Now, if it's 40 years up to life, after 25 years, they will get to go back in front of a judge, and they will get to make their case for release. They will be able to say, you know, judge, look, I participated in all these programs while I was incarcerated. I was able to get my high school diploma. I've become an active member of, you know, a religious faith. I have a job, all of these things. They'll be able to present mitigation. And what the judge will be able to do is say, you know, I believe you're rehabilitated. I believe you've paid your debt to society. I release you now. Or they say, nope, you are still a danger. You're the rest of your sentence has to be served. And I will say it's very difficult to show rehabilitation in prison, especially when many prisons don't give incarcerated people access to programs until they are approaching your release date. And so, again, that is something that attorneys and advocates working on these cases say, well, how can they show that they've grown and bettered themselves as a person if their life sentence or their 40-year sentence is too long to allow them to participate in any programs.
So, and then a lot of those judges, like you said earlier, are the same judges that originally sentenced them to life without parole when they review the cases again?
It depends on if a judge is still serving after 25 years. But with some of these resentencing hearings now, that they often are going back to the same judge. For example, the young man, Markeel Thomas in Clay County, he was sentenced by the same judge again, and so that is something that's common, especially with more recent cases. I would say those judges are often still on the bench.
So we're going to try to get to your calls, as many of them as we can get, and as quickly as possible. Ira on the South Side, Ira, you're on the air. You there, Ira?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you. I was wondering if your guest has spoken with Mayor Curry about perhaps approaching the legislature with a 1% sales tax to pay for daycare through high school care for all people in Duval County as a way to level the playing field for those of us who are privileged to have been through public schools. It seems to me that Mayor Curry, being the king of gerrymandering in the state of Florida, caused this legislature to put into place these very conservative sentencing rules. Would this now be a great time for him to go back and pay for this daycare through 12th grade education system that gives everybody a rise up? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Ira. I guess he's talking about trying to level the playing field before juveniles get to the point of committing any type of crime that could send them to jail or worse. And more generally speaking, Tessa, if you want to.
Well, here's the thing about juveniles sentenced to life without parole and juveniles who commit homicide is that it is not a topic that a lot of politicians would like to use their political capital on. It would just kind of be a re-election campaign by an opponent that would really write itself that, you know, Representative so-and-so or Senator so-and-so fought to give juvenile murderers less time in prison. Now, I don't think it would really matter what the brain science says and what the Supreme Court says, that is really just a negative campaign ad that writes itself, regardless of whether you feel it's the moral or ethical or scientifically supported thing to do.
All right. Well, we're nearing the end of our time. I won't be able to get to more calls, so I apologize for that. But Nancy, can you give me a little bit more information about tomorrow's event before we wrap up?
Yes, it's going to be at 7 o'clock at Christ the King Catholic Church, which is 720 Arlington Road, and we would invite everybody to come out. This is going to be an opportunity to get an update on all the issues that ICARE is working on, not just the juvenile justice issues. But it's also going to be an opportunity to be able to hear from those legislative candidates what their position is in terms of supporting this bill. We're trying to level the playing field in the state of Florida. We have a restorative justice program here in Jacksonville, and we have a sheriff who is willing to work with us, although we're still at only 25%, according to the Department of Juvenile Justice, of eligible youth getting civil citations. But there's some counties that aren't doing anything, and so we want to make it level for all youth in Florida. So I encourage people to come tomorrow night and learn all they can.
All right. Tessa Duvall, do you want to give us any final thoughts about where your reporting will go from here on this issue?
You can definitely watch out for more on this issue. I don't want to give too much away, but just know that this is something that I'm keeping an eye on because these cases are going to be in the courts for years to come, and I intend to keep an eye on it.
Pastor Baber, I'll give you a final word here very quickly. Anything you want to let our listeners know about not just tomorrow's event, but moving forward with legislation?
I just think it's important for us to wake up to the fact that our status quo when it comes to juvenile justice is a draconian and a racist system, and ICARE is going to do everything it can to fight and tear down that system.
Well, thank you to Pastor Philip Baber. Thank you, Nancy Ricker. I almost said Nancy Baber. Tessa.
I don't like that much. I like Nancy. My wife might get upset.
Thank you, Tessa Duvall from the Florida Times Union, for joining me. Much more still ahead. What's the best way to help a former athlete get into a non-athletic life? Representatives from OneCorps 924 will be here to answer that question for us. Later, Culpepper on another disappointing loss by the Jaguars and a historic win for the Chicago Cubs. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
How far have we come toward racial equality since the Civil Rights era? As PBS presents a nationwide exploration of this question in Black America Since MLK and Still I Rise, WJCT will host a televised forum with a panel of experts to discuss our progress with racial equality on the First Coast. Log on to wjct.org/community thread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be part of our studio audience on October 25th. Begin the discussion at wjct.org/community thread.
Before November 8th, get to know the presidential candidates.
In their new book, Trump Revealed, Michael Cranish and Mark Fisher have told the story of Donald Trump's rise as a businessman, a political candidate, but
a little better.
Yeah, let's hear now about Hillary Clinton's journey. My colleague Tamara Keith takes us back almost 50 years to her first attention-grabbing speech.
Be informed. Listen to this station every day.
We'll have it right here on 89.9 WJCT.
YouTube is a multi-billion dollar idea that is oh so much more than cat videos.
Other people can be entertaining. Lots of people out there can produce content that other people want to see.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki. Next time on Conversations from the Corner Office, we'll have the day's business news as well and the numbers from Wall Street. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. She's a young educator, artist, poet, and activist. Well, now she can add published author to that already impressive resume. Ebony Payne English is here to talk The Secrets of Ma'at, which explores the fundamental qualities of wisdom and character with which ancient rulers of Kemet relied on to govern the people. The poetic interpretation of the human experience is a journey of truth, integrity, justice, and balance presented to us through the colorful and inoculating vernacular of Ebony Payne English. Ebony, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Ryan. Thank you.
I want to have you read a couple of passages for our listeners. But first, let's ask about the concept of the book. What is The Secrets of Ma'at? Where did this come from?
some time ago, I found out that a lot of the sacred texts, the religious texts, such as the Quran and the Quran, the Holy Bible, the Book of Mithras, had actually extracted their laws and their moral code from a principle of affirmation that was found in ancient Kemet or ancient Egypt, and it was called Ma'at, the principles of Ma'at. And so there's 42 of them, and okay. I was like, okay, if that's where they take those texts from, I want to know what those are. And so I began studying that way.
So, okay, you say principles of affirmation. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Can you give me a couple of examples of one or two of those 42? What does it mean by principles of affirmation? Personal affirmation, affirmation of others? How does that?
It's universal affirmation, right? So one is I honor virtue. It's speaking to the affirmative, like speaking it as a directive, not as a I try to. There, Yoda, there is no try, only do. Yes.
So essentially the affirmative as in you are doing this.
Right.
It's not I am trying to do this.
Right.
That's interesting because that breaks from some of the like Abrahamic religions where it's all about trying essentially.
Right.
But this is like, no, you just do.
It doesn't tell you what not to do.
Right.
It confirms what you are and what you're already doing, which is, in my essence, it's what I'm about. Like, I'm all about action. I'm all about forward movement. Yesterday is done. What can we do right now, and what can we do better in the future? So
how does your personal poetry fit into this? Were these previously performed or written poems, or did you write them especially for this book?
So once I began studying Ma'at, I contacted my professor from FAMU, Dr. Denard, and I wanted to know about because he's a psychology professor, what role morality played in mental health. So once we started having those discussions and he sent me some essays, I began writing the book. It took me about a year and a half, but it was my poetic interpretation of the principles. So some of the poems I wrote, I took the principle, and then it's what I felt an example of that principle would be, what that affirmation meant to me. And then some of them I wanted to illustrate, like the social ills that are going on and the antithesis of that affirmation, like an example of that not being fulfilled. So.
Oh, right. Okay, so you basically these are poems you wrote specifically through the lens of Ma'at, through that understanding.
Right.
What exactly, I mean, you're a spoken word artist, so mm-hmm. Is all of the poetry that you write just as easily performed as it is read on the page? Because mm-hmm. it flows in a certain way that is very reminiscent of a spoken word artist.
Right. With poetry, people have different things with that. Like, right. Some artists will tell you, oh, the poems that I write in my chapbooks are not poems that I would necessarily perform. But I don't write anything that I'm not willing to share on the stage. So however it comes out is how it comes out. When I get on stage, however it flows out of my mouth, that's how it comes out. I don't know.
So you said that it took you about a year and a half to put this together, right?
Did.
To write the poems and put it together in this context. But what about the other logistics that go on with being published? Have you been published before?
And I have.
Okay. And so how is this different from your previous works, and what publisher did you work with here in Jacksonville?
My previous works were all children's books. So okay. This is very different. They were published through a curriculum company called Education Through Entertainment and Arts Partnership. So they were all for kids, K through five, and they were with illustrations, and they were fun. This was different.
Do these poems come from a personal place? A lot of these stories, and some of them are a little bit more shocking than others. But a lot of these stories seem like they could be any one individual's life.
Yeah. Okay. I don't write. My gift is not just for me. Like, I don't feel like I owe anyone anything except my art, because I didn't pick it. Like, I was born with it. When I was 4 years old, I was writing poems. So this is my human experience, my interpretation of a human experience. And so I hope that someone can find themselves. Out of 42 poems, I hope there's at least one someone can find themselves in, because the human experience is a collaborative one. Like, I can't be human without other people to be human with, if that makes sense. So, right. Yeah, I hope they relate.
Well, I want to have you read a couple of passages here. I guess we'll start with one of my favorites that I've read here. It's I Care for the Earth. It's number 15. Let's see if we can get through both pages there.
Absolutely. Because the sun needs the earth. Because the earth needs the sun. Because without me, your purpose is unfulfilled. Because without you, how can I bear fruit? How can our lineage continue to live? But the sun has separated from the earth, causing us to lose our gravitational pull, and we are off balance, ungrounded, dumbfounded, because just because I can get by on my own doesn't mean I was meant to get by on my own, because a son needs his father, because a daughter needs her mother, because parents need each other, because we've forgotten what a family is, because we've forgotten what commitment meant, because we've forgotten ourselves. We've forgotten each other.
Ebony Payne English, thank you for joining me on First Coast Connect. And
thank you
for this great book. Very quickly, before I let you go, where can people purchase it?
It's available on Amazon.com. And Secrets of My Art, my art is spelled M-A-apostrophe-A-T. And you can get it.
Well, thank you so much. We hope to have you on the show again.
Me too. Thank you.
Back in a moment. On the next Diane Rehm Show, early voting is underway in states across the country, and with less than 3 weeks to go before the presidential election, a look at the latest polls, the electoral map, and end-of-the-line strategies for both campaigns.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
I'm Vince Kong, host of Redux, WJCT's weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. Tune in to catch up on the latest local stories, plus music from our after-hours programming, anytime, anywhere. Subscribe to WJCT Redux now on your favorite podcast app.
Join us as we celebrate a musical legacy that began more than a century ago. Blues Horizon, for the best in classic and modern blues, every Monday night at 11 p.m., only on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, OneCore 924 is a business that serves professional and collegiate athletes preparing to transition from a sports career to the next phase of their lives. The group helps athletes overcome the challenges of transition by providing the tools and techniques through a training program to successfully transition from a sports career to meaningful engagement in the corporate, nonprofit, or entrepreneurial sector. Kim Bynum and Michelle McManaman. Did I get it right?
Amazing.
They joined me now to talk about OneCore 924's mission. Welcome to you both. So how did OneCore 924 start? You know, what sparked the need for this program?
Well, about 4 years ago, I don't know if you're familiar with Sandler Training. Sandler Training is the foundation of the organization. And about 4 years ago, my husband and I own the Sandler franchise here. And we wanted to give back to the community. And we started out by wanting to donate a part of our program to a veteran. And through that, we brought a veteran in, and he was so impressed by what we were teaching him over a period of time that he said, what I'd like to do, as we thought about how we can help him get into the community with a career, what I'd like to do is teach every veteran that I know what you guys have taught me. It's so powerful to help me through my transition as a veteran into the business community. Do you think we can do that? And we'll do it together. And we started an organization called Operation New Uniform, which helps transitioning veterans. So through that process, it has become such a huge success that we realize that this can also be translated to another sector of society, which is athletes, which tend to have the same type of mindset, not identical, but the same type of mindset where they're so tied to their role and what they're doing their whole life in their career that it's very hard to change that role into something new when they transition out. So we started OneCore 924.
So moving off of that, you know, what are some of the specific issues for athletes when they're trying to transition out of the sports world?
I'll go ahead and take that just to link to the veteran world and how we found some similarities between veterans, challenges transitioning, and athletes. Specifically, talking to athletes, we found that a lot of times they're frustrated that folks are unable to see them as anything other than the football player or the golfer or you name that sport person that they were. And we found similar with veterans. Once they took that uniform off, who were they? Some of the athletes find that they don't think they have transferable skills that are going to relate to the business world. Just like our veterans sometimes feel like blowing up that tank or being on that ship may not translate to the business world. And there could be nothing further from the truth for our athletes. So many skills, so many life experiences, work ethic, determination, those kinds of things are highly desirable for our employers.
So when it comes to veterans transition programs, and there are many across the country, a lot of the careers that they get help transitioning into are careers that kind of have an overlap with what they did in the military, right? So if they did logistics or other planning, they help them transition to a career like that. So it's a little bit smoother. With athletes, does the same work for OneCore 924?
So with athletes, what we're finding is that there's, again, different kind of mindsets. So we have, let's say, golfers, for example. Most golfers that you know schedule their own time. They have to be the ones that have to schedule their travel. They have to do a lot of logistics, like you say, to get to where they need to be, make sure they're at their tournament and the practices and everything else, and balance everything that they have to do. So it's not necessarily a niche of logistics or whatever. What we're trying to do is help them open their minds, to open up their whole thought process of what they could potentially do. I mean, some of them love sales. Some of them love to be in an office. And so it's going to be a wide variety of different things that they can do. We just want them to be able to see that don't limit yourself because you have done this sport for your entire life.
So we have a little bit of time left, and I want to get two more questions. So for my next question, what is the process for helping these athletes transition? Is it sort of like a graduated program where you go in for 6 months or a year and then you graduate, or how does that work?
That's a great question.
Thank you for asking. So OneCore 924 is designed as a three-week program. We believe in no quick fixes. You're not going to be able to change somebody's mindset in a two-day boot camp. 3 weeks of intensive, interactive, small team environment where we work on those mindsets through attitudes, behavior, and techniques. We meet three times a week in a very small group setting with other athletes so that they can share experiences and support each other and hold each other accountable. The first week really focuses on mindsets, and then we move into some of the behaviors and the techniques that are specific to how do I sell myself? How do I discover who I'm going to be and how I'm going to contribute and what's going to be the next phase?
All right. So very quickly here, in the last few seconds that we have for the segment, I want you both to give me an example of what was one of the most difficult yet rewarding cases of transition that you've had thus far. So I'll start with you.
Well, we have a football player right now going through the program that is just to watch someone grow in that space, to be able to say that I didn't think I had any other talents that I could put toward a second part of my life, and watching him and his family just receive that type of growth in their lives is really, it's just powerful.
For me, the most rewarding, we worked with a pro golfer, and watching somebody move from being unsure and unclear to the confidence and how that brought their family back together, that was really powerful for me.
All right. Well, thank you to OneCore 924's Kim Bynum and Michelle McManaman. I got it again. Good luck with your mission, and we'll be right back.
Presenting Next Avenue, the website from WJCT created specifically for adults discovering life after 50. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's where grown-ups keep growing. Sponsored in part by AARP. Real possibilities.
Classical music is available 22 hours a day on WJCT 89.9 FM HD2. Find out how you can listen to classical music by calling 358-6390. Enjoy classical music day or night on 89.9 HD2.
Welcome back. And finally this hour, a rough day at Everbank Field. It was a bloody Sunday at Everbank as the Jaguars looked frustrated, had two players ejected, and lost to Jack Del Rio and the Oakland Raiders 33-16. To talk about the game and other sports news of the week, we are joined now by Cole Pepper.
It's amazing, Ryan, how quickly things can change. The Jaguars rode into yesterday's game on a two-game winning streak. They hadn't lost in nearly a month because of the bye week, and then had a complete meltdown in the loss. In the span of four snaps, defensive tackle Malik Jackson committed three penalties, two of them unsportsmanlike conduct calls. That got him ejected. Rookie cornerback Jalen Ramsey was tossed for fighting. After the game, veteran linebacker Paul Pazlesny and tight end Mercedes Lewis were particularly incensed at the amateur hour performance. Lewis stood up in front of the team, called out the poor play and lack of composure, while Pazlesny, who is one of the most solid professionals in Jaguars history, was just absolutely beside himself in the locker room with reporters afterwards. Just couldn't understand how, once again, this team lacked the discipline to be competitive. And this was against a Raiders team that came in dead last in the NFL in total defense. The Jaguars managed most of their yards in garbage time, perhaps the ultimate insult with a fourth down run by the Oakland punter, who sprinted 27 yards off a bad snap, got a first down. The punter. Fair play, he was fast, but Still, it's the punter. This is the kind of loss that, coupled with the Jaguars' other failures this and past seasons, can cost people their jobs, players and coaches. But because the Jaguars are now 2-4, they play on Thursday night in Nashville against the Titans. I don't expect there to be any more major moves this week. Another bad performance against the Titans on Thursday, and you could see something potentially happening after that game. It's just been so much, and I think Gus Bradley is certainly going to be in the crosshairs on this one.
Yikes. All right, well, let's move to some happier news then. College football, we have the Florida-Georgia game this weekend.
The world's largest outdoor cocktail party comes back to Jacksonville, and the RVs have already started arriving. They'll begin loading up in RV City tomorrow officially. All of the usual pageantry, including the Hall of Fame luncheon later this week. Both the Gators and Bulldogs come into the game off a bye week, and Florida has plenty to play for, while Georgia has something to prove. Gators are in position to potentially win the SEC East despite a less than impressive offense this year. The Bulldogs are scuffling under first-year head coach Kirby Smart. My prediction, a low-scoring game in this one. I'll take the Gators 20-13. Seminoles also coming off a bye week. They have a huge game Saturday against Clemson. A win and FSU can salvage their season. A loss, and there's going to be some unrest in Tallahassee.
All right, so finally here, this is not necessarily Jacksonville, but Chicago Cubs fans who live in Jacksonville, including our own digital content editor Vince Kong, who may be listening right now, were very, very, very happy with the game this past weekend. So tell us a little bit about that historic game.
Well, for the first time since 1945, the Cubs have made it into the World Series. They will play the Cleveland Indians. It's the long-suffering Cubs fans against the long-suffering sports fans of Cleveland, who finally got a championship last basketball season with the Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron James. I will say this. Back to the Future was just a year off.
All right. Well, Culpepper, thanks again for joining us this Monday, as you do every Monday with the Sports of the Week. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. Next on Diane Rehm, early voting is underway in states across the country, just over 2 weeks before the presidential election. That's next. I'm Ryan Bankin for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT in Jacksonville, your community, your world. Melissa will be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.